Hi, I'm Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It's been widely reported, though not always focused on, that women make up the bulk of the job losses in the American economy over the last year. Some of the reasons are intuitive. If you look at areas of the economy that had to shut down, and in some cases stay shut down, women are highly represented: childcare, hospitality, service sector. But there are other reasons, too, some related to children. If kids are learning from home, someone has to be there to shepherd the children through their remote lessons, or even just to be present when there's a lack of childcare or in-person schooling. And overwhelmingly, though of course not exclusively, that burden has fallen to women. And for some women, trying to do both, work from home and care for children, has just become untenable, and they've left their jobs. Those women are often not even counted in the unemployment picture, which often focuses on unemployment claims for people who have unwillingly lost their jobs, or the unemployment rate, which generally only includes people actively looking for work. So the picture for working women in this pandemic has been bleak. And if it's bleak for women, it's not really good for any of us. We're going to talk about that today, both the national picture and the situation here in Vermont. Joining us for the full hour today is Stephanie Seguino, professor of economics at the University of Vermont. Among the several things she focuses on is women in the workforce. It's nice to talk with you today, Professor Seguino.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Why is Vermont's rate of women filing unemployment claims higher than anywhere else in the country, do you think?
I think it has to do with the kind of occupational segregation that we have in Vermont, and in particular, the concentration of women in some of the hardest hit industries and occupations, especially accommodations and tourism, restaurants, and so forth. Those are a larger share of the Vermont economy than others in other states, and women are particularly concentrated in that sector.
Is that it? You know, is that sort of can we point to that as the real main reason why Vermont's rate is higher, that it's just job sector specific? We have more of the jobs where women are typically highly represented than other states?
You know, I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, there can be some component that is gender discrimination. That is, if employers are laying off workers, they may see women as secondary wage earners, not needing the money as much as men. So that's a possibility. That said, that is typical in the United States. I haven't seen anything with regard to that for Vermont in particular, but that's definitely a possibility.
Yeah, I mean, I think about some of the states where I would imagine there are even higher categories of, you know, service sector workers, hospitality workers, than Vermont, and even perhaps childcare workers who, you know, some of whom have lost their jobs permanently, which is a little bit different in many cases than those who work or worked in schools in particular. But, you know, I wonder about Vermont because it seems like, you know, in many ways we've been more balanced than some of the other states. And yet here's this picture where Vermont's rate for unemployment for women is just really high, highest in the country. And it's a curious thing. Is it curious to you or does it not feel curious?
Well, let me add this as well. So there's a little bit of a complication in understanding this issue with regard to the data. Mm. And if I might just sort of clarify.
Yes, please.
The unemployment rate is measured. It's an official measure. When you respond to a survey, have you worked for pay or profit for an hour or more in the last week? Filing for unemployment claims is different only because an expanded group of people are now allowed to sign up for unemployment. So mm-hmm. that means gig workers, people who have been part-time workers, self-employed workers. And so it's possible, you know, that some of this has to do with a higher level of self-employment, the many small businesses in Vermont. And so that may be part of the phenomenon as well. So just to be clear, filing for unemployment right now is different than it was before COVID because of this expanded set of categories. And that might be part of the explanation as well.
Do you think that it opens new areas of study as well for Vermont professors like you who are interested in the economic picture? Like maybe there are more women in Vermont's workforce who are gig workers or who are part-time workers who were sort of inadvertently having them be revealed now through this unemployment data through the pandemic.
You know, I have been concerned for some time that the official unemployment rate actually fails to really capture the degree of lack of access to income, because there's a very, the definition, as I just described to you, means that it ignores people who can't afford to go to work because childcare costs are too high, people that have been discouraged because they've looked for work and haven't been able to find a job, and people who are involuntarily part-time employed, and disproportionately, that is most definitely women. So we really need a new measure of access to income through employment. And so, yes, I think this is revealing that in a more definite way. And it absolutely means that we, and policymakers in particular, have to begin to look at different kinds of data to understand this degree of lack of income.
Professor Seguino, are we seeing women come back into the Vermont workforce at a rate equal to how quickly they left the workforce in 2020, as we see the jobs picture improve pretty significantly over the last several months?
I haven't seen that data. I think the December data is the last that I have seen with regard to new claimants. And for me, that suggests that there may be flows into and out of the labor force. But the new claims just suggest that this churning is happening and women disproportionately are affected.
Let's bring another voice into the conversation here. At the John Graham Housing and Services Organization in Vergennes, they're seeing an uptick in the number of women, especially single moms, who've been reaching out for help during the pandemic. Here to share a little bit of what women are telling them about their circumstances is the assistant director, Jess Horner. Hi, Jess. Nice to talk with you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little more specifically what you've been seeing since the pandemic began?
We're seeing really the consequences of more economic instability and among women especially, where the ability to juggle probably a minimum wage job most of the time with educating their children, combined with just the day-to-day hardships of, say, your car breaks down, that can mean the end of employment. And so once that starts, we know how hard it is to get back into the workforce, and it creates this cascade of need. And so we're seeing a lot of women come to us with those needs.
Is that different, that you think, than previous to the pandemic? I mean, is there something more specifically going on that you're seeing a higher representation of women than previously? Because, you know, we've talked with your organization before, and women are often highly represented, especially women with children, in needing to find services for various reasons.
Yes, definitely. I think that the pandemic has exacerbated all the social ills that pre-existed this difficult year. And so we're seeing, you know, job sector segregation and discrimination. Those effects, especially for women of color, are just amplified. So there was always a high need in that population, but now we're seeing it exacerbated.
Do you think there are different realities for rural Vermont women than perhaps for women in Vermont's more populated Chittenden County areas or other places that you know, people who live in an area where they have closer geographic access to services or to grocery stores or to their jobs might not anticipate, that you could tell us a little bit about being in Vergennes and serving people around the community?
Absolutely. There is a big difference on a number of levels. And like you mentioned, access to grocery stores that you can even walk to, having access to a car, where if you don't have, you know, good public transportation nearby, it could be almost impossible to get to a job or to pick your kid up from school. So we're seeing that. And then also in the smaller counties, the housing stock is very limited. So we have a number of families right now who we could house with vouchers and funding through the recent stimulus legislation, and we just don't have any housing. So I think that is an issue unique to rural Vermont.
You've also been dealing with, as you always do, but perhaps more so now, questions about food insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
What specific to the pandemic do you think has changed?
I think just patterns. I mean, this is all anecdotal, but from what I hear, patterns of how people carry out their day. So people are home more and maybe eating more. And then having to make choices if they lose their benefits or their job about how to prioritize certain types of food or who in the family eats. And so it's just been kind of a reorganization of relationship to food and food insecurity, which existed before the pandemic, but now again is exacerbated.
For families with children, you know, the schools have been working really hard to try to make sure that, for example, that access to food is still available, even if children are having to learn remotely or to do hybrid learning. And, you know, that's been a real concern of everybody, but especially school districts, trying to figure out how do we make sure to get food to children who rely on this and families who rely on free lunches and free breakfasts from the school. And then also technological barriers that school districts have been trying to work through as well, of trying to make sure that for remote learners, there's a tablet they can use. Lots of schools are giving tablets, for example, to students. But then the students still need reliable internet access, which, as we know, is a big problem in Vermont. How are the families that you work with just trying to cope with all of that?
Oh, my gosh. It's so hard. And it's my impression that the schools have done a great job, especially with the food. But with the children and families that we see, you know, just reliable internet access is really the biggest barrier. I mean, even among my own staff, sometimes they have to make a decision on, am I going to join the Zoom meeting or are my kids, you know, going to be signed into their classroom at this moment because their internet, it just can't support all of that activity. And, you know, I have worked with a number of moms who are trying to do, you know, work or appointments just on their phone, and it's not sufficient. So it represents a huge barrier to staying connected and just staying healthy.
Yeah, I mean, not to mention the people who are trying, as you said, to work with an internet connection that may be unstable or the lack of any kind of computer or tablet. I mean, I also live in Addison County. I didn't have strong enough internet to work from home and had children at home and was trying to juggle that. But I had a place that I could go to work and access technology from work. I was allowed to do that. And I had a partner who I could juggle the childcare needs with. And that's not the case for all of the families, and especially the single moms that you work with. So in some cases, Jess, are they finding that it's untenable to have work, you know, that they can do right now? Like, they just can't do it.
Yes, absolutely. Women are leaving the workforce either because they can't do it and they're let go, or because they can't do it and they're choosing to focus their efforts on their children's schooling. And I see a lot of hopelessness and helplessness around that, where it's just, okay, well, we can work when we can work, and hopefully the kids get to school today, you know, on these various classrooms. And it's very, I guess what I'm trying to say there is it's very disheartening over time. I think it's a constant struggle and people are getting tired.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You also work with some undocumented workers and families, and I'm curious if you could share a little bit about, I mean, that's a sector of our population who often don't have a lot of attention and often don't want a lot of attention paid to them. And yet, you know, what they're struggling with may be exacerbated right now. And what can you tell us about the undocumented population and workers and people who you're helping?
That is a particularly difficult area of our work right now, because undocumented workers and families aren't eligible for a lot of the benefits that are coming down the pipeline. So what's available to other Vermonters is not available to them, and also they may not be able to work. So we're talking about situations where they have absolutely zero resources and are supporting themselves and their families on food shelves and donations and connection with agencies like ours.
In some cases, they should have been eligible for some extra money that Vermont made specifically for undocumented workers who hadn't been able to get those initial stimulus checks. Just didn't go far enough, Jess?
I don't think so, no, especially families with kids. It just, the need is so great, and especially with housing discrimination, those kinds of payments won't support long-term housing and stability. And that's a tall order, but it's definitely just a Band-Aid.
What do you think, from your perspective, would help that hasn't been done, knowing that, I mean, a lot of people are trying to help, and if this is an unprecedented situation, but what do you think could be done that would actually have an impact?
In the longer term, we need desperately more affordable housing in Vermont. And so that's a little bit longer term thinking. And in the immediate, I'm not entirely sure. We just keep serving people. And I know the community has been so generous. We get donations all the time to pass on to families. And just continuing to track the trends that we see through the pandemic and figuring out how to legislate in a way that's more sustainable to endure these crises going forward.
Jess Horner is the Assistant Director of John Graham Housing and Services in Vergennes. Jess, thank you very much for talking a little bit about the families and women who you're serving.
Thank you.
We'd love to hear from others of you who have experiences to share, who are moving through this pandemic and struggling with children and work, or children or work. You know, what's it been like for you? What do you see in the data that you could illuminate through your own personal story to help us understand better? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can send an email to vermontedition@vpr.org. Stephanie Seguino, professor of economics at UVM, is with us. And, you know, you were listening to what we were talking about with Jess Horner. Do you see things like in this current stimulus package, relief aid package that has moved back from the Senate to the U.S. House now, things that might specifically help women and therefore help bring our economy back to a level that has, well, at least the equity that it had before, if not total equity?
You know, I'm excited about a few things in the Biden bill, and perhaps the most important is the child allowances, which are around $3,600 a year per child under the age of six, $3,000 per year for children over the age of six up to the age of 18. So that means, you know, for a family with two kids, that they will be getting an extra $600 a month, every month. And estimates, there are numerous studies been done of this, and the estimates are that it will reduce child poverty in the United States by 50%, and in Vermont by around 35%. I just think that is one of the most fundamental positive things we could do with this money. And for many families that are struggling, for women who are struggling, who maybe have lost their jobs or can't afford to child care, this might help with that. So there are many ways in which that is going to reduce the psychological burden, especially for single mothers who are the ones who I think really deeply struggle in a crisis like this because they don't have a partner to share childcare or care issue and as well as bring in an income. I think that there will be funding that will go to state and local governments. That's going to be important because that is going to save the government from cutting jobs and cutting services. And disproportionately, typically those jobs that it does fund are ones that are held by women. And disproportionately, women tend to benefit from a number of the services that are provided, whether it's healthcare, education, and so forth. So all in all, I think this is excellent news.
Let's go to Pippa, who's calling in from Jeffersonville. Hi, Pippa. Where do you intersect with this conversation?
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. I still am sort of a yoga studio owner. And I just feel like the yoga studios have been underrepresented in the mainstream media. I think most of them have been forced to close, mine included. And we're in Jeffersonville, so it's a town of roughly 4,000. So it was just a big hit because we had been about 4 years in the making and it was a really beautiful space.
I'm sorry to hear that, Pippa. When you say you think yoga studios have been underrepresented, why do you think that is? Are you seeing a gender dynamic at play there or just not getting the attention you think they deserve?
I'm actually not sure why. I feel like the restaurant industry has been in the limelight. But I think if you think about the yoga studios, I don't want to generalize, but probably most of them are women-owned. And I have no idea why it's underrepresented I just haven't heard on the news. You know, I haven't heard on the news about yoga studios closing, and I know since I'm right in it that so many were affected.
So what does this mean for you, for your future, for your earning potential, for your career choices and options moving forward, Pippa?
I'm in the creative space at the moment.
I think that laugh said it all too, didn't it?
I'm homeschooling my 5-year-old with her father and with some other moms in a homeschool pod. And I'm just trying to see, think creatively as far as the yoga goes, maybe turning a yoga studio with walls into a yoga studio without walls and just teaching outside.
Well, good luck to you, Pippa. Thank you for sharing your experience with us. And I hope for all the best for you as we move through this and into the future. Professor Seguino, we were just talking with Pippa, who ran a yoga studio and feels like yoga studios are not getting much attention. And at least in her case, are still shut down. I asked her if she saw a gender dynamic in that, and she wasn't sure, although she thought that most yoga studios are probably owned by women. Do you see a gender dynamic in what gets talked about, what gets prioritized, what questions come up in the Vermont press conferences, you know, all of our conversation about who's losing out and who's benefiting during the pandemic?
I'm reluctant to make a deliberation on that, but I think there are two things that are really under discussed that are so fundamentally important. And that is, what is happening to single parents? And second of all, what is happening to children in terms of children living in households with too little income? I find that the discussions around that are really missing. And when you think of the fact that over 25% of Vermont's children live in single parent families, if we don't discuss that and don't address those problems, then, you know, that has a long run impact on our economy, because children who live with those kinds of financial deficits have longer run problems in terms of shortages, in terms of cognitive development and a variety of skills and emotional development because of the stress of their families, which affects productivity in the long run. And so we, I think, are shooting ourselves in the foot if we actually don't center the discussions around kids that are growing up in single parent households.
What would that look like? What would centering that conversation look like to you?
Well, let me just say that I think that the Biden, the recently passed Biden plan is one that clearly did center that in terms of the child allowances, which were very important. In general, I think that we have to figure out ways to support single parent families in terms of care work, the impediments that care work provides in terms of obtaining a paid job and juggling both of those. So it's both lack of resources and lack of time. And so solving the time problem, I mean, one possibilities, for example, is subsidized childcare especially for single parents and low income households. So in general, I think there needs to be sort of a Marshall Plan, if you will, to address the problem of single parent households, which in the United States, in Vermont, for example, almost half of those households live in poverty. And we know that the poverty threshold is absolutely inadequate to determine the actual financial needs of families. So it's a deep problem. And we see the problems with children in schools who face these financial stresses. So I think it's a multifaceted issue. It's both support in schools, it's support with childcare, and it's also employment support for single parents to be able to manage work-family balance. And I have to say that, you know, the passage of laws requiring paid sick leave, for example, have been important. Paid parental leave will be fundamentally important. Those are some of the policy approaches that could address the issue.
I just want to pull out one of those stats that you just mentioned and highlight it, because it is pretty striking. You can look at the Vermont Commission on Women's data dashboard that tracks the impacts of COVID-19 on women and girls in Vermont and see some of them right there. But one that Professor Seguino mentioned was that about half of Vermont households headed by women, where there are children under 5 in the household, about half are living in poverty. And that is an incredible number just to think about for a moment. Getting more calls and emails and thoughts from many of you. Christine in Ferrisburg says, my heart goes out to all the women suffering from so much COVID-caused hardship. When this hit last year, I was a salaried engineer. Like everyone else, I spent March, April, / summer trying to continue my typical work duties and many extra home duties. In August, when my daughter started first grade in a hybrid model and my son was enrolled in a preschool with considerably less hours of care than we previously had, and they were not the same hours and days my daughter was in school, I voluntarily switched to a temporary hourly working agreement. I worked minimal hours between August and February and was paid accordingly. At least at this moment, I do not feel that I am bearing the brunt of economic toll. In some ways, I feel like it took a global pandemic for many professional women to be able to engage in motherhood to the extent they desired. Our car odometer just passed 209,000 miles, and we are pinching our budget. But the time and energy I've been able to pour into my family this past year has been a gift. I recognize how fortunate I am to be in this position of choice, and I'm hopeful that I'll be able to return to work in my old capacity at some point. I'm tremendously grateful to my coworkers who are stepping up and pulling more than their part during this time. Let's go to Shayna, who's calling in from Middlebury. Hi, Shayna. Go right ahead. What's your experience?
Hi, I just wanted to speak a little bit to the childcare aspect for not, of course, single parents during this time, but even families that have two parents in the household.
Yeah, go right ahead.
So both my husband and were working before the pandemic. We had our baby in March when this all began, and coming into this, I had to leave the workforce, and coming out of it, just thinking about having to make that choice between finances, childcare, where do we find that money? Are we comfortable making that safety choice for our baby, putting her back into that? So I just think it's important that, you know, policies are taking that into consideration, that childcare needs to be not just for this time period in this pandemic when people are needing that support, but coming out of this as well.
Shayna, in your household, do you feel like the burden of that emotional labor of trying to figure out what the options are and your comfort level with all the options, are those shared equally between you and your partner?
I think that being the person that's with her every day and to not sound like, I think my partner definitely takes it into consideration and helps burden that. But I think just as a mother, of course, I feel more weight and constant anxiety of anything, of course. I mean, this was my first child. And every little decision I made felt like it could have a devastating impact on my child's health. So I think it's just such a heightened time of anxiety that I think all mothers are feeling a real emotional stress.
Well, Shayna, thank you for sharing your experience and congratulations on your still somewhat newish baby and on making it through all of this. I wish you all the best. Let's bring another voice into this conversation here as we're talking about moms and working women and the burden of trying to navigate all of this and what the choices are not only for yourself but for your family if you have children. Michelle Holder is an associate professor of economics at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, and her research is focused on Black women in the American labor market. It's a pleasure to have you join us, Professor Holder. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's my pleasure to be with you.
You know, we've talked a little bit in this program about women being disproportionately represented in unemployment claims and job losses and leaving the workforce, you know, quote unquote, voluntarily, which isn't even counted in most of the official tallies. But if we dig deeper, there's an even more disproportionate level of job loss for women of color and Black women in particular. Why is that?
So there are a couple of reasons why I would say that Black women during an economic downturn, which is, you know, what we are in, we are coming out of, but it's what we've been in for at least the last year. There are a couple of reasons why Black women would, you know, face a perhaps a steeper uphill battle in terms of their experiences in the American labor market. You know, number one, there still exists in this country an educational attainment gap at the level of college degree attainment. And so if we looked at and kind of compared college completion rates between white Americans and Black Americans, there's about over a 10% gap. And, you know, one of the things that's very clear, at least definitely in this country, is, you know, the more educational attainment you have, the better you are positioned in the American labor market. And so, you know, that because, you know, African Americans complete college at about just over 20% rate for, you know, African Americans 25 years and older, compared to really a 35% completion rate of college for white Americans, you know, that in and of itself would feed into disparate labor market outcomes. But one of the other things I cover in my research is, you know, if we think about the fact that women writ large, whatever their race or ethnicity, in the American labor market are kind of crowded into low-wage jobs, they, you know, as a gender, hold the less favorable position in the American labor market. You can imagine what happens when gender and race get cross-hatched. And so really what Black women face is this kind of double penalty associated with not just their gender and their race. That goes, you know, that applies regarding wage disparities that Black women face, and that also, you know, goes regarding unemployment rate differentials that Black women face.
When we look at Vermont-specific statistics, Black women in Vermont are living in poverty at over twice the rate of white women in poverty and higher than the national average for Black women. Yep. 26.9% of Black women in Vermont are living in poverty. Does that illustrate what you're talking about, do you think?
It does. And, you know, let me add in the dimension of parenthood, because Professor Seguino talked about this. You know, one of the poorest demographics in this country are women with children. Over 30% of, I should say, single women, right? Single women with children. Over 30% of single moms are officially poor. And so, but when we start to sort of look at single parenthood by race and ethnicity, the group with the group with the highest, or I should put it this way, 66% of Black children in this country grow up in a single parent household, primarily single moms. This is compared to, you know, about 25% of white children, about 40% of Latinx children, and about 50% of Native American children. And so right there, you see that there's, you know, this real gulf in terms of the proportion of children experiencing poverty when we look at it through the lens of race and ethnicity. But the overarching thing is that there are proportionally more single Black mothers than there are for other ethnic groups. And that already, you know, puts that group at a, makes them vulnerable to issues of you know, not being able to pay their bills, not having enough food to put on the table, et cetera, et cetera.
I wonder, too, you know, we were talking with Professor Seguino earlier in the program about the fact that there's not a ton of data yet that would tell us whether or not women are returning to the workforce in as great numbers as they left the workforce in 2020, and that will have to shake out as we see more data over time. But if you're thinking about families with children headed by one parent, a single parent, which is primarily a woman, that's going to have a significant impact on whether women are able to return to the workforce as they continue to struggle with childcare issues and hybrid or remote schooling.
Absolutely. So, you know, I did just this past Friday, the so-called jobs report came out from the Department of Labor. And, you know, all of the economists and policy wonks kind of, you know, just kind of wait with bated breath to see where did the unemployment rate go? Did it tick down? Did it tick up? But one of the things that really doesn't get a lot of attention is, you know, how many people left the labor force? And in my examination of the numbers that were released on Friday, it's clear, right, that more women have left the labor force over the course of the pandemic. You know, between about, I'd say, nearly 3 million women compared to nearly 2 million men. So proportionally more women did disengage from the labor force during, you know, this horrible health issue, this virus that we were facing. But even then, when I deconstruct the numbers further, it's proportionally more Black and Latinx women. This is not to say that white women did not leave the labor force. They absolutely did. But Black and Latinx women left the labor force at a proportionally higher rate. And so, you know, once again, we look at what's happening in terms of gender, and women absolutely got hit hard during this pandemic in a variety of ways. But when we look even further, it's women of color who really bared the brunt of you know, kind of the most disparate outcomes.
Yeah, and perhaps that K-shaped curve, economic recovery curve we keep hearing about, which always confuses me, the K part of it. But at any rate, where you see some people trending back upwards and other people not even holding steady, but in fact trending downwards. Maybe, to me, it seems more like a sideways Y, but that's not really to the point. But this impact where some people are recovering and doing better and some people are not, you know, when we look at the who are nots and see women and women of color on that downward trajectory, that should trouble all of us. We're talking today with Stephanie Seguino, professor of economics at the University of Vermont, and Michelle Holder, associate professor of economics at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. And let's go to Jess, who's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Jess. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Tell me a little bit about what you're experiencing.
Sure. So I'm a single mom of four school-aged children, and I've been a single mom for a number of years, and I am a resident of Vermont for just as long. And I think, if anything, this has really exposed an underlying issue that we've had with the lack of support and essentially an outdated system that we really need to create a more robust system for single moms and those who are struggling with balancing the homework, life, and education roles. I was in a domestic violence shelter for quite some time with my children, and I wasn't able to work, and I ended up having to homeschool them for a number of years. And so COVID hitting has really been, for me, kind of like an exposure to the rest of society, I think, of these issues. But with that has come the fact that we've lost our housing now, and there's been a substantial price gouging, I feel, with the rentals in the area and across the entire state, that now I'm actually not even able to secure housing for myself and my children. So, yeah, I'm not really sure where to go with that. I mean, truly just my personal experience right now, and it seems to have spiraled a little bit out of control.
Yeah, Jess, boy, what a challenging situation you're dealing with, and I really appreciate you highlighting your own experience because it helps to highlight the situations that you're talking about. You said this is an exposure that other people have had, perhaps, to situations like yours and what you were already dealing with. So, you know, given that this could be a moment for a reset or a deeper look into policies and how they affect everybody and how we could better support single moms in a situation like yours, do you have any ideas? I mean, do you even have time to have any ideas about what you think might change policy-wise or what you'd like to see done differently?
Yeah, you know, I think that there's a lot to be spoken for the affordable housing piece and the housing discrimination piece. I think that's something that's deeply embedded in society and our culture as a whole, that policy is decades behind, quite honestly. It's almost as if we need to completely wash it all out and rebuild from the ground up. But also creating a job system and an economy where it is more feasible for folks or women in particular to be able to work outside or within the home so that they can try to balance things better. I mean, I don't think that it's a big newsflash for anyone that this really shook the ground of the fact that we're so embedded in, you know, structured office settings and buildings that, you know, we weren't able to even create those jobs or enough jobs to be remote. So I think looking at it from a career perspective, a housing perspective, and, you know, I am eager to see when this Biden stimulus package hits and to see, you know, how that will actually benefit our family.
Yeah, Jess, thank you. I wish you the best as you navigate through this time and the times yet to come. Thank you for calling us and telling us about it. Stephanie Seguino, could we pick up on what Jess was talking about there and what we've been talking about with Professor Holder as well, and the opportunity we have now to support single moms in particular as we look ahead to making a better situation for Vermonters and for, you know, Americans moving forward?
Yeah. Was there a question there for me, or would you just like me to comment?
I'm just curious, you know, what you hear or what you see as a possibility when you think about situations like the one Jess described.
Yeah. First of all, you know, I think that when one thinks about what she has to deal with and the labor commitment that she has every single day to take care of her family, as well as the emotional stress, I doubt that many of us could even fathom how challenging that is. Here's what I think. I think that this crisis has really revealed the extent of the care economy, the exceptional time and effort it takes to care for people, whether they're sick people or to invest in children to develop their human capacities. And I think COVID has opened a lens into just how much work there is that is being done, most of it unpaid by women, and the challenges that poses for people who also want to be able to work to provide income for their families. You know, we have an outmoded system in this country in which it was built on a sort of male breadwinner model. The man went to work and the woman stayed home and took care of the house and the children. The world has evolved dramatically for a variety of reasons. One is that women have desired more economic independence, but also declining wages, especially for people with high school educations and less, has meant that more women have had to join the labor force. But our workplaces are not family friendly. And I find that to be one of the most striking challenges that we face, but it particularly weighs heavily on single moms. And I'll just give you an example of a few years ago. I was taking a ride to the airport to go on a work trip, and the taxi cab driver was a woman. We were talking, and she had told me that she worked at a local firm, actually a subcontractor of the University of Vermont, and she was required to work in the evenings, and she asked her employer, she said, "Can I just have from 7 to 8 p.m. off? I'd be glad to come back to work after that. I just need to be home to feed my child." She was a single mom. And the employer said no, and so she lost her job. I don't think that, and I have read many stories, especially for single moms, of not being able to afford childcare, needing to go to work, and often being required to make impossible choices. Several years ago, when I was doing some work in Maine for moms that were welfare recipients, one mom talked about the fact that she had a 2- and 4-year-old, and had to work the midnight shift and leave her children home alone because she didn't have extended family, and she certainly didn't make enough money to pay for childcare. Those are impossible choices, and it's true for single fathers as well, and for many parents as well. So we need to begin to create the conditions and incentivize employers to acknowledge the need for work-family balance if we're really going to be a healthy country.
Professor Holder, yeah, what do you think we could do to move that forward more quickly, especially as we see, you know, more families where if they're two-parent families where the woman is the breadwinner, still not, you know, certainly not equal to men in heterosexual families, but, you know, where we see more women who are the breadwinners for their family, and certainly in single-parent households where we need women to be able to have that economic opportunity and that flexibility that Professor Seguino was talking about.
Right. So I absolutely agree with Professor Seguino. You know, we need to understand that fully over a third of women in the American workforce are mothers. And so, you know, obviously their a concern is childcare. Now, this has been a difficult problem because of, you know, school closures and hybrid learning, and certainly the closing of childcare centers during the pandemic. We need to invest in child care availability, particularly for low-income women. I would say that would be, you know, that should be a priority in this country, making childcare affordable for women who are low wage workers, because it simply is not.
Yeah. Yeah. And simply is not for low wage workers, but often for even middle income workers. Childcare availability and affordability is a significant issue, even as you move up the income ladder.
Totally agree. Totally agree.
Well, you know, this story is certainly not over, but I really appreciate both of you joining us for this conversation today. And as we look ahead to what happens for women in the Vermont workforce and women in the workforce in the United States, as we move out of the pandemic, we hope, but into what kind of reality remains to be seen. Stephanie Seguino is a professor of economics at the University of Vermont. It's a pleasure to talk with you, Professor Seguino. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Michelle Holder is an associate professor of economics at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. Professor Holder, a pleasure to talk with you, and thank you especially for highlighting the disproportionate impact of COVID-19 on women of color in the U.S. Thank you for your time.
Surely. Thank you.